everyone. Welcome to another episode of Kyle and Patrick's Yet To Be Named podcast. I'm Patrick McEwen, a.k.a. the Lacrosse Film Room Guy, here once again with Inside Lacrosse Gear and Lifestyle Editor, Kyle Devitt. So, Kyle...
That's a great... I think we should just call it The As Yet Unnamed. That's a great podcast title.
The As Yet Unnamed.
We have to do our podcast title banter to start every podcast, or people won't know what's going on.
Okay.
That's my theory.
You interrupted, though. That was my written out introduction. What do you think of it?
That was good.
Okay,
that was good. I liked it.
Since there has to be an introduction, it's an old competitive debate saying that readers beat talkers. And so,
really, readers beat talkers.
Yes.
Huh. Nah.
Yes.
I'm a big reader guy.
Well, it's more that if you do the prep ahead of time and write out what you're going to say, you will be faster and more succinct and not sort of ramble. Rather than if you are just speaking purely off the cuff. And when we're talking to, this is competitive debate, so it's less, at least the event that I participated in is more about substance than style. And so,
yeah, I didn't do any debate stuff, man. I was busy being a JV soccer player or something. I don't know what I was doing.
Oh, okay.
I'll take your word for it, though. It sounds very applicable to our field. But as we know, you are the play-by-play debate style, and I am the off-the-cuff at all times color.
Right, but I mean, it's just more. If we were to do this podcast without an outline of what we're going to talk about, it would be worse than if we had some sort of, you know, outline of the topics we were going to cover, right?
Well, that's true, and we do have an exciting show for everybody. It's fall ball. It's October. It's cold.
It is cold.
Let's kind of get into kind of first reactions from a bunch of the scrimmages that happened over the past weekend.
Before we do that, though,
what were your takeaways?
Before we do that, I think it's important to remind people of what we talked about on a previous podcast back in September about not overreacting to certain parts of fall ball. And number one among them is the final scores of scrimmages. And
Yes. Based
on what I saw on Twitter, I think not enough people either listened to that podcast or actually believed us.
Yeah, I think they don't believe us. I think, and it's also a pride thing too. Like when your team that you follow or root for, or your nephew played for, did really well against a top team, you want to pump them up.
Well, but that's
you
want to
think
that's
it has
thing,
a lot more
the confusion
meaning.
Is the final score is not synonymous with having done really well.
Correct.
And that's the difference. Is in the spring when we're talking games, when it's for real, the final score is synonymous with doing well, for the most part. But in fall ball scrimmages, it is most definitely not.
Right. Right.
So with that in mind,
who were your kind of teams that stood out from all the recaps that we have up on InsideTheCross.com?
You know, rather than just repeating, I guess, what other people had to say, I was going to say, I went to the two sets of scrimmages that I went to this past weekend. I went to the Ohio State inter-squad scrimmage on Friday. And then I went to, it's 18 teams at a scrimmage, it's called Cross Out Cancer is the name of the event over in Cleveland on Sunday. And I wrote recaps of both, but I guess, I don't know, it's so hard to talk about, I guess, people who stood out based on other people's reactions. I don't know, did you have anyone aside from that you wanted to mention?
I mean, I think everyone was kind of talking about Harvard and how Harvard brought all these freshmen and plugged them in, and they have to fill so many holes from that departed senior class. It's one of those cases where I actually kind of believe in some of the hype here. Morgan Cheek is going to be a junior this coming season, and he's going to lead a lot of the offense, whereas, you know, he's known for that 9-goal game against Brown, but really his main contribution was as the catch off the dodge scorer for Harvard. And I think now he's going to have to transition into a playmaking role. I think all of these guys that are, you know, jockeying for playing time for Harvard are really going to be worth watching. And you're going to see, you know, hopefully Harvard put it all together and not be ravaged by injuries like they have been for the last 2 years. I think that's kind of the one that stood out. Obviously, everyone's talking about, you know, what we said we weren't going to talk about, which is the final scores of like Notre Dame losing, quote unquote, losing to Navy and Stony Brook by a goal and two goals, respectively. I mean, it's unofficial stats. It's whatever. Notre Dame is generally regarded as a top three team, I would say, going into the spring prior to any of this action. But I think, you know, Navy showing well is great.
I guess I would have them. I mean, I think they're close, but I don't know that I'd have them top three.
Top five.
Okay, that's probably.
They're a top five team. Yeah, for sure. On everybody's board. But I think, you know, we're doing a cover story on Navy for the next issue of the magazine that we just put into the printer last week. And I think them showing well is really great for, you know, for the midshipmen, for the Maryland region, Annapolis, and all that stuff. So I think that was kind of the two main takeaways, just reading through the articles. As everyone kind of knows, I've been doing a lot of D2 stuff. I went to Merrimack. My Merrimack feature went up last week. Franklin Pierce is coming up this week. And I'm going to finish off with St. A's. So I made all these visits. And it's so – one of the reasons I wanted to do it, just to touch on it briefly, is every school is so different, even though they're really within like an hour and a half of each other. But all three of these schools that I'm highlighting, they're all in the NE10. And they couldn't be more different. The schools, the programs, the coaches, the players, could it be more different than any other three programs in any other division of sports? It's really striking to see the campuses, the facilities, and the attitudes are different on each team too. I think a lot of people that read the Merrimack one are going to see a lot more swagger than you're going to see in a Franklin Pierce team that's perpetually kind of in that middle range rebuilding phase, but their past kind of being, you know, at the bottom. St. A's kind of in, as well, in the ascendancy of the NE10, playing top teams to one goal games. The reasons behind those two teams in particular's ascension to the likes of someone like Merrimack, Adelphi, Lemoyne in the NE10 is just as interesting a story, I believe, as anywhere else in lacrosse. So I was really happy to get those visits done and talk to those coaches and get really unprecedented levels of access to the programs. And I think, you know, going forward, it's definitely something that we should focus on more, as I think a organization is keying on all these programs that make up lacrosse. It's not just the top 20. You know, there's so many other stories and inspirational things going on in the world of lacrosse that aren't just in D1.
Oh, yeah, no, that's one of the things I love about going to the Crossout Cancer scrimmages. And, you know, a big reason why I made it a point to go back after being there last year is that there was only – Canisius was the only Division I team there. And I liked what I saw from them. They looked like a Division I team playing Division III teams, which I think is what you're – really, for the most part, what you're hoping to see in a scrimmage like that. And especially Jeff Edwards, who's a midfielder for them, one of the top scoring midfielders in the country last year on a points per game basis, which is especially noteworthy considering that Canisius played pretty slow and that they didn't face off particularly well, which means less possessions. But he imposed his will against a couple of Division III and Division II defenses, I think is the best way to put it. But getting to see so many different Division II, Division III teams go around, talk to kids, because they're there all day. And so there's a lot of downtime in between scrimmages. It's really a lot more like almost like a high school summer club tournament, where you have four fields going on, you know, scrimmages. Everything starts every hour on the hour. There's a new set of games coming up. And so you have just people standing around. Every team kind of has their own little camp somewhere. A lot of parents, you know, bring out a table with some food, you know, to feed everybody lunch, get water, snacks. And so you can just kind of walk around, watch a ton of different games, talk to a ton of different players and coaches, all in the same spot.
Yeah, and I think one of the other things we were talking about before we went on air here is you did an interesting thing on your Snapchat.
Yeah.
You wanna talk about that?
I guess if you didn't, it's gone now, so you can't go see it. But on my Snapchat, I did with so many Division II and Division III teams there. I did what I think is probably going to become a regular feature of my Snapchat whenever I run into Division III, Division II programs. I did 10-second recruiting pitches where I got a player or a coach from, I think I managed to get, I think, 11 or 12 of the 18 teams that were there to do, you know, just in 10 seconds, sell your school.
That's amazing. You got to do that again, like, in another setting. We should add that to our summer events list, is having the coaches pitches.
Yeah, in the future, whenever I'm at a summer, like a turn anywhere where there's a number of Division II or III coaches, I think I'm going to do it. Though the interesting thing about it that I thought was most kind of a learning experience for me was that a lot of coaches, when I kind of asked them, you know, like, hey, I'm doing on my Snapchat 10-second recruiting pitches, you know, do you want to do one? A lot of them really had no idea what they were going to say. And really had to think about it, which I thought was kind of interesting. That you know, you would think that's something you would do on a regular basis is need to, you know, to have just two or three quick. What are the two or three things that you are trying to sell a recruit on if you're talking to somebody about why they would want to come to your program?
Yeah, I mean, the there's a lot of choices there. You know, do you sell yourself? Do you sell the school? Do you sell the program? Do you sell, you know, other aspects of the experience? And I think the best coaches will probably try and do all those things at the same time. But 10 seconds, you kind of have to make a choice.
Oh, yeah, and a lot of them.
And I wouldn't be surprised if a bunch of them sold themselves as well as the school.
I don't really think any of them did, to be honest. In a lot of cases, I was surprised at how many of them actually wanted to defer to one of their kids.
Oh, really?
And they didn't want to do it. Yeah, and they wanted to make one of their players do it.
Wow.
It was also interesting to see there were a couple of coaches who did that. Some of them wanted their player to do it and then wanted to approve it before I posted it. And then there were a couple that would call a player over and say, you know, here's the kid that should do it, and then would say, I'm gonna go walk away. I don't care what, you know, I don't want to know what he says.
So who was the best one? You watched them all, obviously. Who was the best one?
I probably would have to go with, if I was gonna pick one, I probably would have to go with Worcester.
Really?
Yeah. But I think one of the advantages to having a player pitch it, do it, is that unlike a coach, they can say, we have good-looking girls.
That's a differentiating factor. And I will grant you that.
And I liked it because it slid into, you know, you know, it's a great education, love the campus, like, good-looking girls. And it was just one of many things in there that I think. So that would be my take on it. But, I mean, there were a number of them that were pretty good. So, unfortunately.
And I got to say, it's Worcester, not Worcester.
No, it's Worcester.
Because if you hear anyone, but if you say Worcester anywhere up here, they'll be like, there's a Worcester?
If we're talking about, there is one in Massachusetts, isn't there?
Well, Worcester State, they don't have a cross, but there is a Worcester State, but there isn't, they don't have a lacrosse team.
Okay, well, but it's Worcester State.
Just saying. If it's in, you might confuse some of the people.
It's up northeast, yes, but it is Worcester, Ohio.
Yeah, okay. But it's spelled Woostr.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's just like, it's okay. Like,
differentiating factor.
Yeah, it's like it is, the state is Oregon, but it is Oregon, Ohio. Or the city in Kentucky is Louisville, or if you were to say them more like Louisville, if you have a little more southern accent. My cousin from Kentucky tried to teach me how to pronounce it once, and I was not very good. But there is a town in Ohio by the same name that is Louisville.
Huh. I have an excellent accent to make fun of all of the Northeast, but I'm not going to bust that on this podcast. I'll save it for a time of need. Where do we want to move on to next? Do we want to talk about kind of the big reveal on IL this week that we contributed to?
Yeah, let's go ahead and talk about that. So the big announcement from Inside Lacrosse this week was the launch, the sort of formal public launch. It's been publicly viewable on the site if you snooped around for a while now, but is the Inside Lacrosse recruiting database. And that is sort of the next evolution of recruiting coverage by Inside Lacrosse. And the way I would sort of describe it is it's headed more towards the kind of model that you see in football and basketball, where you have kind of a database of all potential recruits, and you're assigning sort of numerical rankings to all the different kids, like, you know, 5 stars, 4 stars, 3 stars, that sort of thing that you see in football. And it allows you to have a little bit more quantifiable way to evaluate recruiting classes across all of Division I. That sort of previously the class rankings are sort of done a little bit more hand wavy, as, well, I think they have a couple of really good kids that we really like, and we don't like these kids so much, but there's no sort of quantifiable way to say who has the better class based upon some more concrete evaluations of the entire recruiting class.
Right. And, you know, we should say that obviously we're biased pushing this, but we do think it's going to be a game changer. We've both done evaluations throughout the summer. It's part of the reason we went to almost every event. I think you and I went to everything except one each, I believe. And we had some overlap there to do our evaluations. And, you know, the thing is, it's not just us, you know, as a staff doing it or as freelancers. We brought in, you know, coaches, like active college, you know, coaches that had been assistants, coaches that have had coaching experience, club team coaches as well did some input here. Big extended network.
All the coaches at the Community Academy event this summer filled out evaluations for some cases, I think all of the players on the teams that they coached.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking like Liam Banks,
Chaz
John Tucker, Chaz Woodson. Yeah, big, you know, guys that know what they're doing and have been involved with evaluating players and getting players recruited and their own club teams for some time now. So I think it's an introductory thing. It's only going to get better. But as it is, I think it's pretty great.
Yeah, that's
I know our evaluation styles are fairly similar. I'm a little harsher on players with my rankings, probably. So, but I think that's good. I think there's people that should be more harsh and less harsh on certain things, certain players that they look for. Obviously, you're a guy that will look for defensemen, and I'm a guy that will always kind of look for hustle plays and LSMs and, you know, impact makers, guys that I look for IQ. As well as speed and strength, stuff like that. So I think we have a lot of nuanced viewpoints on what makes a player good, and I think it's just going to come out with the ultimate kind of evaluation of talent. And I think it's going to be a standard for the industry going forward.
I think so, and I think there really isn't anybody who has the reach that Inside Lacrosse does in terms of putting like something like this together. Just the
absolutely
the amount of staff. I mean, this is something that has been in the works for years, really, because it's not just it was a very monumental project when you think of how that just the design and the infrastructure in terms of figuring out what it's going to look like and then the programming, the back end. That went into it. I think there was a really good job done by the web development guys at Inside Lacrosse, by Wes and Mike and Zasha.
Shout out to the web devs.
Yeah, this is probably their first mention on the podcast.
I mean, they do a lot of work that I don't understand. I like went in their office once and they had a computer that looked like it was reading off symbols from the Matrix. So I'm not really sure like what they do, but It's very valuable to everything we do. And also this database, which could not have been easy to construct. And, you know, it goes hand in hand with the release of kind of our recruiting issue that has come out recently that I think everyone will have in their hands by the time they listen to this, I believe.
Yeah, it's been out. It's been out for weeks.
I just saw it in the local bookstore up here. So it's definitely only been out for a week up here, but I wasn't sure if everybody's gotten it. Great lead story on the cover.
If you are like a male subscriber, MAIL, like if you get it in the mail, you've had it for a while now.
Correct.
So,
and if you aren't, you can go subscribe at InsideTheCross.com.
Yeah, or you can
in our online store
to the digital edition.
InsideTheCross.com/subscribe
and just get it electronically whenever it comes out to read on your iPad or whatever.
Exactly.
Anyways, though, the next topic I think we wanted to transition into was gear, and things have been a little slow. In previous podcasts, we kind of talked about all of the September releases of gear for the holidays, but we're now well into October, and we're still waiting on some of it.
We're still waiting on a lot of it. We're still waiting on a lot of it, man. As of this kind of podcast on, we're taping this Wednesday night, October 12th. The Clutch Elite stuff for Brian is out. STX has teased their Surgeon 500 protective line, but it's not actually available to be purchased yet in a lot of places. The Regulator Max came out last Friday. The reason this is remarkable and something that we should talk about is back in the day, companies used to kind of release their entire lines together, and now they're doing it piecemeal due to the kind of how the containers coming over from the manufacturing, because most of it's done in China for a lot of these companies, is getting done. It's delaying a lot of production time, and orders aren't being fulfilled. I think the only true entire line that is out and able to be purchased right now is the Maverick Max line. Warrior STX, Brian, all have kind of pieces. So like Brian has the King Super Light 3s out, but there's no full-on catalog availability for all these companies. And back in the day, it used to be like, oh man, I can't wait till the end of September or the beginning of October when all the stuff comes out. Now you're lucky if it comes out the day it's announced in a lot of places, unless it's ahead. I think companies have prioritized getting heads and doing their release dates for heads more than anything else. But it's really strange that we're still in this position, basically middle of October, where we're still waiting for a lot of stuff. And it might not even be here until November now, which, you know, I think it's – I don't know if it's indicative of – any like industry manufacturing issues or if it's an organizational thing, because it's not just one company doing it, right? It's all these companies doing kind of piecemeal releases and waiting on, you know, stuff for the holidays. But like, this is the time. This is your exposure time. You know, a lot of, you know, people, we talked about this previously. When you're growing up, your stick is bought at Christmas. You know what I mean? Like Christmas Day, like expecting, if you're a lacrosse player, like, I get a new stick today. This is awesome. Or I at least get like a gift certificate to go buy my own stick.
Right. It's different now. A new head and then maybe one other, like either new gloves or a new helmet or a new shaft or, you know, something, I feel like is the pretty standard for a lot of youth players and high school players in the country.
Yeah, and I mean, this is a trickle-down effect to other companies as well. Obviously, everyone's anticipating the East Coast Dyes head that's coming out, and that's, you know, kind of a product that is guaranteed to sell, basically. You know, like, that's money in the pocket. Their reach is so great, even though they're a smaller company than some of the other manufacturers backed by, like, you know, New Balance or even Under Armour or Nike or STX. But you see that a product like that that's guaranteed to go, and they want it. it's either them controlling the release or getting it perfect or, you know, having the right quantity to get out there. And I think the supply and demand of lacrosse, you know, retail is really what's kind of driving this shift of timing, because teams are, you know, stores are having to place booking orders that are larger and larger every year, you know, and that's so the companies can make back their money selling to the retailers, but it's also so the retailers can have the access to the item and try to get a sell through so they can reorder, you know, and place like if you're buying, let's say $200,000 worth of Warrior, you're buying $200,000 worth of STX, your reorder, you're probably doing $10,000 reorders too. So I think what we're looking for is the high ticket. Why aren't the high ticket items out? Why aren't the midline items out? I did notice a lot of youth things are available right now, youth packages, Maverick STX kind of leading the way with that. Partnering up with, you know, Maverick has the advantage of having to give a CPV with that, but or a CS, if you will. I think going forward, this is a troubling trend to see for an industry that's supposedly growing. I don't see it.
But I don't see the everything being put on time. By the growth, though, is that you have more different companies trying to launch more products, and there's more competitive pressure to get the launch, to not have things screwed up at the launch.
Yeah, but I think we're not even doing launches. We're doing launches at non-traditional times. Like, this is the traditional time right now is when companies would make their push, 10, 15 years ago for this is our new line. Let's push that. We're going to buy this. We're going to push this. And what you have seen that is an indicator of a little bit of a slack in the growth is that companies are keeping lines for 2 years, 3 years, sometimes 4 years instead of, and while they're doing that, they're developing a sequel in that line. Do you know what I mean? They're getting like, you know, we have the Brian Super Light threes this year. We had the twos like 3 years ago, you know, so we're, and we had the ones, you know, 2 years before that. So we're sequelizing everything. It's like Hollywood up in here.
Speaking of which,
you know,
though,
everything is a sequel.
I do want to say that I felt like the writing was on the wall for a while, but with the Regulator Max is essentially the Revo 4, which I feel like is a bit of a nostalgic, it's sort of, you know, RIP to the Revo, the Revolution heads, or at least the name, I guess sort of they live on in spirit as the Regulator Max, but I felt like that was a bit of nostalgia for me.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing you'll see with that, though, so that's the second gen of quote-unquote the Regulator head, but what you're also going to see this year is a Regulator pad line. So a lot of these companies are going to this, you know, it's kind of like a hockey strategy, right, where they have, or even like an apparel line, a soft goods strategy, where you have you see the Clutch Elite line for Brian,
right,
you see
right,
the Surgeon line for STX, and it's all one thing, so they get you to buy...
STX is the Surgeon and the Stallion lines, like Warrior, it's the Regulator and the Evo and the Burn.
Yes.
And the Rabel.
So you can outfit head to toe in one kind of, and each line represents something different, right? So the highest end line for STX is a Surgeon 500 line. You know, they have gloves, they have arm pads, they have shoulder pads in that line.
Right, and they're even
this
going
year.
To where they keep the same name for the other stuff, and it's the Surgeon 300 and the Surgeon 100 are like the youth beginner and the intermediate, like junior high targeted stuff.
Right. Stallion 200s, for example. I mean, you know, Warrior does that with the Next series, the Rabel Next, Evo Next, things like that. So, you know, they're trying to make things simpler, but I actually kind of think they make it more difficult by making everything kind of the same, because how do you tell the difference between the Evo line and the, you know, Evo as the helmet, but you're wearing the burn pads from last year versus the burn pads from this year versus the clutch pads? And, you know, mixing and matching is kind of what a lot of players do anyway, unless they're, you know, required to wear whatever by their college team. But
the one that confuses me is with the heads with Warrior, the Regulator is sort of the head is their defensive aimed one.
Right.
But the Burn is sort of their light and fast aim stuff. But traditionally, the pads then are sort of the opposite. That if you're a defender, you want the light and fast pads. And if you're an attackman, you want the light, fast stick. But you're looking at the more heavily protective, you know, arm pads and shoulder pads.
Yeah.
And I haven't quite figured out, you know, what's going on with that. Because it seems like the burn pads are like their light and fast ones, right?
Right, but they're also the middle line. So they're not considered, you know, the highest end line. The Evo Pro, by the way, Evo Pro this year, line is considered the highest end line of everything. And that actually combines kind of what you're talking about a little more succinctly. I think burn is actually a little, like you're saying, skewing more light. But also I think your inference about position is dead on too, because you really want, there's a huge difference between a burn head and a Regulator Max head. And I think it's about 2.5 ounces. First of all, second of all, it's the design of the head is one is designed for a defenseman and one is not.
Right.
So yeah, that's something they have to reconcile. I think that's all related to cost and marketing as a highest end kind of thing. But again, you're always going to see elbow pads be cheaper than arm pads, right? That's just a matter of material, regardless of how high the end
is. And I think having pads that are named similarly makes sense, especially if you're talking about like with arm pads and shoulder pads, where you have pads that are lighter and less protective, where it makes sense just to learn like, oh, this is their lightest, least protective line of pads, and this is their heavier, most protective line.
Right.
It doesn't make sense to name your shoulder pads something different than the elbow pads, because you essentially want to convey the same things. But I'm not a huge fan of naming, of then using the same names as you do for the heads on your sticks.
Yeah, I think that's just them following suit with other sports, to be honest with you. Hockey in particular, in this case, because as it relates to sticks. But, you know, I think it's interesting going forward what we're going to see. I think a lot of companies are staggering their releases. Like you will see, you know, Christmas, like post-Christmas releases. You'll see in-season releases. You'll see end-of-season releases, summer releases, things of that nature as companies kind of pull back and try and make pockets of their money throughout the year to fulfill different parts of their, you know, quarterly needs. Because, you know, the manufacturers, people don't talk about this that much. Manufacturers got to make their money too, man. That's a big thing. Manufacturers got to make the money back. And all this investment going into lacrosse, as we've talked about before, has a lot to do with futures. But a lot of these strategies relate back to present. And present is what we're trying to get into. But the fact that stuff is changing and you're not getting everything all at once is indicative of the marketplace, but it's also indicative of a shift towards something where you're not trusting as much of your initial release or the Christmas window, which I think could be troublesome as we keep going on and smaller companies keep popping up and going away, and bigger companies like Gate, who had, you know, had that Rawlings money and still now they're not around. You know, I think that's not always the best sign of things to come, but it's definitely something to keep an eye on, and it's disappointing for me to want to have the gear in my hands to touch and use and, you know, check out and evaluate for my own purposes and also purposes of for the magazine. But the next thing we wanted to move on to,
MLL talk, and I think the place to start there is the news that you broke yesterday on Twitter about Rochester.
Yeah, the Rats, man. The Rats will be staying in Roch for 2017. Note that it says for 2017, not just staying in Roch. I think, you know, there was a deal You know, it was there. We reported it here and in other places. Not formally, because nothing was ever announced by the league.
That they were working on a deal to look towards moving it, moving the team.
Yeah, and I think, you know, again, the thing is, the financing wasn't there. You got to put up money for an MLL team, man. It's not cheap. You can't just, like, conjure one. You know, a lot of owners get fed up with not making their money back in the short term, and you just have to be ready for that.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's more than – I say more so than even in terms of gear, that's a place where if you're investing in the MLL, it's all about futures.
Yeah, you really have to bide your time to get your money back. You're that's like a 10-year – 20-year plan to make your money back. It's not a get-rich-quick scheme at all. But I think, you know, the Rattlers staying in Rochester gives us another year of Tim Sudan as an MLL coach. Gives us another great team that with a great story going forward. Team that emphasizes, you know, community and team and like a us against the world mentality that I really am attracted to. I know I get crap all the time from people being like, oh, you hate on the Rattlers. We know you hate the Rattlers. I'm like, no, I don't hate the Rattlers. I'm just not a huge fan of Rochester, the city. But that's because I've been there and nothing good has ever happened to me in Rochester. But the team itself, I mean, I love that team. Like Jordan Wolf, Ned Crotty, Joel White, John Galloway. I mean, these are all top tier players on the planet. Forget MLL, the planet. And I think being able to see them, if I lived in Rochester, I would go to every game. They're a great team. They're a great team to watch. Great players. I think, you know, obviously the stadium is troublesome. They're not making a ton of money at the gate. Attendance is very low, but, you know, I think they might get Joe Walters this year.
Oh, I think that's player he's movement. A Rochester guy. And he filed for player movement. And so that was likely his target destination.
Yeah, and I think that kind of makes them into the super team to rival the Lizards. I really do. I think it makes them into a super team. So I think if that all transpires, I mean, listen, it's great they're back in Rochester. I'm kind of bummed that we didn't get a move to Dallas. But again, like I said, I wanted to see Sudo coach again, and I would hate to see that team broken up prematurely.
I think it's not so much that we don't want to see a team in Dallas, but I feel like if the MLL – They need, if they're going to be a viable league, they need to have a team, an upstate team. There's sort of three hotbeds in lacrosse. You have Baltimore, Long Island, and upstate New York. And if the MLL can't figure out a way to sustain teams in those three spots, I don't see how it's going to be successful.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people were calling for them to move to Syracuse. There's a comment on the article saying move to Syracuse and have an expansion team in Dallas. That being said, I would not be surprised if the Rattlers were playing in Dallas in 2018.
Well, I think it's something needs to be done with the Rochester team, whether it's moving to a different place in Rochester, you know, a different ownership, moving to Syracuse, wherever they, whatever.
And ownership period. That isn't the league office would be preferable.
Right.
Yes.
That's what I meant by different office, but or different ownership. But I guess speaking of, well, I guess I missed the transition, but Joe Walters potentially moving to Rochester. Speaking of movement in the MLL, we had some players be traded earlier this afternoon. Atlanta sent Demer Class, Wells Stanwyck, and their first-round pick to Charlotte in exchange for Dylan Donahue and the Hounds' first-round pick. So you end up with Atlanta moves back. It's basically a three-spot swap. Atlanta moves back three spots in the first round, and Charlotte moves up three spots from 3 to 6 and 6 to 3 as part of that deal.
Yeah, and what's your – I think we have different takes on this.
Yeah.
So what's your initial reaction to that?
We texted about this earlier, and we do have different takes. So my take, I think this deal makes a lot of sense for Charlotte, but I'm not so sure what the thought is from Atlanta. Because I was kind of curious as to why Charlotte used such a high draft pick on Dylan Donahue.
Yeah.
That I think he made sense for them as a value pick in the second round, just because he's too good to let slip that far. But as a first round pick, I wasn't sure the one position, or one of the positions that they were really set at, was a lefty attackman with Joey right. Sankey. And I wasn't sure why you would want to double up on that when you had other spots where you had needs.
Well, Sankey's an initiator, too, and he doesn't just occupy the left side. He goes right, actually, a lot, and rolls back to his left for shots.
Oh, yeah, no, it's not to say that they couldn't work together, or that it was a problem, but it's just more that I thought that they had other needs that were more pressing, and I wasn't... Sure. And that's also how I feel about Atlanta, which is why I'm not necessarily a huge fan of this trade for them, is that their third leading scorer from this past season was Mark Matthews. That granted, I mean, he only played in 7 games. He's only there for the last half of the season. And so they do need a lefty attackman to start the year. That is a problem spot. But I'm not sure they need to have invested this much in acquiring that. That I feel like they right. need a midfielder like Demer Klass more than they need a lefty attackman. Because if you look at once again at their scoring... their fifth leading scorer and their second leading midfield scorer was Scott Ratliff. And that's
yeah.
that's a problem.
I mean, is it though? That's why they moved for Ratliff. It's not because he was local, it's because he's the best LSM, his best offensive LSM in the league.
Well, I still think it's a problem though. I don't think you're going to win an MLL championship when Scott Ratliff is your second leading scorer from the midfield.
That's a fair argument.
It's not. It's argument. Not that it's a problem that he scored as many goals as he did, or as many points as he did. It's a problem that you didn't have other midfielders who scored more points.
Well, you know, I mean, Atlanta's just like trading guys that they supposedly built up to take. Like they traded away Jones famously, and now they've traded Klass. I mean, this is my theory. I think they're kind of like the Sacramento Kings of the MLL, just like doing wild stuff, trying to like build up this monster attack because they're going to run everything through the attack.
The selling point and the reaction on Twitter was, you know, like, oh my God, it's the Syracuse attack line back together, Rice, Stotts, and Donahue.
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess that's a selling point in terms of, I mean, it's a selling point. It gives you like, you know, for the kind of Syracuse South that, you know, Liam Banks is building.
Well, he's no longer affiliated with
right, but I mean, the Blaze. Yes, but I mean, but he's pumping up. There's a couple, what's his name? Who's the other Syracuse All-American who coaches with LB3?
I don't recall off the top of my head.
Either way though, you know, it gives you something to sell to people though, and that you're coming, you know, it's sort of, that's what, you're coming to see Rice and Donahue, which I think is a better potential selling point from that perspective, but I'm not really sure that this gets you more wins on the field.
My counter to what you were saying is, and this kind of viewpoint is, that Atlanta will run through Rice and that they want to run the ball through the attack. And you saw kind of the construction of their roster before the off season, before this player movement, was a bunch of guys that played both ways. And I think they thought, you know, Tucker being the coach there, the thinking was, well, we can get guys to fill the middle of the field, stop transition and create transition, but have the attack finish it. And obviously that did not work out for them, except for when they played against Ohio. They were one of the only teams to beat Ohio twice during the year. And they did that by doing just that, is controlling the transition and not letting Ohio have tempo control. That being said, I think some of the moves they made were a little savvy. I mean, they definitely made a move for Kiminer. Kiminer is criminally underrated as a third midfielder, you know, and that's the thing about Klass. Is Klass a number one midfielder? No.
But I mean, okay,
I'm sorry,
but
no.
But is Ryan Tucker a number one midfielder?
No. They have no number one midfielder. So in my mind, if you're not dealing a 1-for-3 or a 1-for-2, depending on how you see Donahue, and if you watch him towards the end of the year, he was much more a number 2 than a number 3. I think Ryan Brown and Donahue had trouble playing together. They got in each other's way a lot.
Right,
they occupied very similar spaces.
Makes sense for Charlotte. I think the questions that people had about those draft picks, I think, kind of played out. And so I think unloading one of those guys for a different player makes a lot of sense for them.
Right, and I think, but you're looking at Charlotte and Atlanta as at the same level. They're not. Okay, Charlotte established themselves as a blue-collar, workhorse, well-coached team that needs more talent, right? And the place where they need more talent is in that midfield. Klass is a very good three, possibly a decent two, and they already have Shannon Chuck and Haas.
Yes, that's why this makes a ton of sense for them. I think this is a very good trade for Charlotte. And it's the kind of thing where it's potentially the move that gets better fit. So it's sort of a contend right now type move where you're looking not so much to necessarily increase your talent, but to get pieces that fit better together.
Yeah. And also Charlotte was pretty noticeably silent for a lot of this player movement stuff. Right. We didn't see a lot of guys declare. We didn't see them sign guys.
Right. And by moving three,
they want to have a fluid existence.
By moving three spots up in the draft as well, you also give yourself a chance. I think they're looking at this. There's a clear top three in this draft of Perkovic, Dylan Malloy, and Connor Cannizzaro.
Right.
And I think any one of those guys would be a great fit. Would be a great fit to round out like that top six, or in case of Perkovic, he'd just give you a fourth midfielder.
I think he's not going to be there. I don't think he's going to be there. I think they're targeting, you know, a guy like Malloy actually Cannizzaro makes a lot more sense for their offense.
Sure, but either Malloy or Cannizzaro gives you a righty ball carrier to balance things with Sankey. And then you have Lyles Brown, is an ambidextrous finisher, gives you an incredibly balanced, the fit between those three attackmen would be ideal.
Right.
And those are the kind of talents. Yeah. I think Malloy and Cannizzaro are both the kind of talent that have the potential to be an all-star attackman type elite level player that maybe isn't even available there, that isn't available at the end of the first round.
Right. And that was the problem with Charlotte, really, is everything went through either the top two guys in Shannon Chuck and Haas. Haas got hurt for the playoffs, or Sankey. And Sankey got the crap kicked out of him all year. So now you get one of those guys in there, and all of a sudden your team is looking a lot better. That's another couple wins with another ball carrier in your back pocket, to a reliable ball carrier, even at the pro level, I would say. Both those guys project to be, you know, similar roles to what they do for their college teams, right? Like, we're not...
Yes, oh yeah.
We're not trying
they're,
to...
They're deaf. I mean, I think Dylan Malloy potentially becomes more of a righty as opposed to the X guy.
Yeah.
And I think Connor Cannizzaro has the potential, is versatile enough that you could run him out of the box. But I think he has the athleticism.
He's a little small. A little small.
Okay, but I think he is the type of athlete I don't think you want him playing defense, but in certain contexts, he has the ability to do like what Will Manny did for Boston, running out of the box.
Yeah.
If you wanted.
That didn't really work, but I see what you're saying.
I mean, they both have the potential to be, you know, really realistically, there's nine teams and you probably need at most two ball carrying attackmen per team. So you're really looking, there's 18 spots for sort of elite level ball carrying attackmen. And I think both of them have the talent to be one of those 18.
Right. No, that's fair. It's a good point. Any reaction from the 23-man rosters that were announced?
It's very belated, but I thought the most hilarious reaction... Did you see the tweet from Matt Bertrams about his dad's reaction?
I did not.
He tweeted a screenshot of a text between his parents where his mom texted him and his dad excited that he made the Bayhawks 23-man roster, and his dad texted back... wow, definitely did not expect to see that.
That's tough. That's a tough beat from Pops. That's rough.
It is, but it, also at the same time, when I saw it, I just thought it was hysterical. And when I thought about it again, I thought about, man, somewhere out there, there's untold numbers of high school club coaches who are like, why can't I have parents like this on my team?
Right. Oh, of course. Of course. I think just looking at it, you're talking about Bayhawks, Anthony Kelly unprotected, Poppleton unprotected. The only other surprise on here, I mean, Tyler German, they traded for Poppleton. You know, I mean, that's a guy that's just, you're chalking that up to a loss for nothing. I think Ryan Flanagan being unprotected by the,
oh, that's true,
the Hounds,
that's true. I almost wondered,
was surprising.
Is that a sign that they don't think he's going to be back in time to start the season? And they're gambling that nobody else is going to want to waste a pick on an injured player who lives in Charlotte?
Maybe not. Maybe not. I mean, I'm with him. I actually am going to the ortho tomorrow to see if I tore my MCL. So I'll be doing rehab at the same time. Feel you, man. It's got to be tough.
Also,
I mean, I'm not making a roster, but whatever.
My other reaction was that player movement was a huge, like, it was a secretly huge benefit for Rochester because they had so many players file for player movement, which meant that they didn't have to put them on their 23-man roster.
And they're all going to re-sign with Rochester.
Right, but basically, I went through and looked, and Rochester only released two players who had even played in a game for them.
Yeah.
And they played, one guy played in three games, and one guy played in one game. And so basically,
what, Vanthoff and Miller? Right?
I forget who they were, honestly.
Vanthoff played.
Yes.
It was Vanthoff and Miller.
Okay.
Yeah.
But anyways, basically, they were able to protect anyone that they had even any sort of marginal interest in.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's a, which I think is a flaw that's going to need to be addressed in the future. Because thinking about that,
yeah.
if I were a coach of a team, why wouldn't you want players, especially players that you had relationships with and you knew weren't going to move anywhere? Like, for example, if Greg Grenlian, who just, you know, bought a house on Long Island with his wife and is expecting a kid, is not going to go anywhere other than New York, if he had filed for player movement, he would be a spot that they wouldn't have to put him on their 23-man roster.
That's an interesting take. I mean, that kind of presupposes that the 23-man roster matters at this juncture, which I would contend it does not. The supplemental draft isn't until December 14th. So that's basically what this is to create the supplemental draft. Okay.
Right, but I mean,
so
you know, I guess,
all these guys getting released are automatically in the subdraft.
Right, but I mean, but especially given that so many players live in and around New York and would love to play for Long Island, I guess you don't think there would be benefits for them to be able to have protected more guys?
Well, there's also benefits for other teams to circumvent that and pick that player up. Or like try to pick that player up in a subdraft. So the flaw in what you're saying is that you're not holding the subdraft to the standard of you're on a roster if you get drafted. Your rights are owned by whoever drafts you the subdraft, which is true. So even if you file, right,
for player,
if you don't sign,
no.
Yeah, but you have to sign.
What? Well, there's all these,
so these guys,
guys
have to sign.
They have to sign by the supplemental draft.
That's the idea. That's the idea.
Oh, okay. So then Rochester's going to have to then unprotect guys when they sign
the player. No, they have to release guys. They'll have to release guys once they sign them. So I think...
Oh, okay. Then
this is the thing.
Mind.
Do you see what I'm saying? Like, this is kind of the, like,
so, like
gray area we're
like
working
Galloway
with.
Galloway and Ned Crotty, who filed for player movement, when they re-sign with Rochester... Rochester will have to release guys from their 23-man roster to make room for those players.
Or Rochester could forego picks in the subdraft to have their 35-man to have those guys signed to.
Okay, but
so essentially, actually, what you're saying,
right, that's still a benefit,
yeah, what you're
for
saying
Rochester
is right, but you can still get drafted if you're unprotected, not just player movement.
Right. I know. I'm just saying, I think doesn't it, it create some advantage for like Rochester, because they had so, by having guys file for player movement and then re-sign, it's an advantage for Rochester, and it shouldn't be.
Yeah, but
because that's something that can be exploited in the future.
Presupposing these guys they protected are going to make an impact, though. I don't see a ton of these guys. I don't even know who Scott Tota is,
but
or Sal
point,
Tuttle.
Though, is that Rochester, I don't know who they Rochester are. Basically protected everybody they could possibly want.
Right, but no one else wants them. So what's the point? Do you see what I'm saying?
I mean, I guess
because the reality is the MLO works like that. You know, it works like that. Very seldom do you see the poaching kind of aspect to like leaving a guy unprotected. I mean, actually, it's funny. The most famous case of that happening is when Chicago had a franchise and they grabbed Grenlian, and Grenlian was like, I'm not playing in Chicago. Peace. And sat out an entire season. He got DNR'd and didn't play the whole year. And, you know, now we know him as an MVP. This happened in like 2009, you know. So there are teams that do that. I think the all the teams now and all the players in the game now that are running these teams understand there has to be a level of kind of professionalism that wasn't there probably 6-7 years ago. But at the same time, like, there's still people like kind of poaching guys off of practice squads.
Right.
You know?
I just mean it's now at the point where Grenlian has a image stake in playing and sitting out. He's going to like not just lose money from not getting paid, but it hurts his branding.
Yeah. That's a good point.
Off the field income, related to his image as a dominant MLL faceoff guy that he foregoes if he doesn't play. And there are plenty of guys in the MLL who don't rely on that branding. And I think that's why, like, you know, like Paul Rabel's not going to sit out in protest because he has too much of a financial stake in being, you know, in his image. But there are marginal guys who don't have that same stake.
Yeah, that's fair. All right, so we want to wrap it up here.
Yeah, I guess one last topic that I think needs some more in-depth explanation. That was a topic on Twitter that a lot of people didn't understand last week or 10 days ago, when the news broke that Tom Schreiber and Kieran McCardell had signed NLL contracts.
Right.
And I had a discussion in the wake of that with a MLL player who had signed an NLL contract, who I can't name, because it has obvious impacts on their negotiations, who explained to me that one of the big motivations for signing that type of contract was negotiating leverage to sign a marketing addendum. It's supplemental money that the team would pay in addition to their above and beyond their contract under the salary cap for marketing related things that essentially would require them to show up to all the games. So if you're on an NLL roster and you're missing MLL games to go play in the NLL, you wouldn't get your marketing addendum money. And so that threat is a way basically for a player to go to their MLL team and say, if you want me to be at all the games, you need to pay me the difference of what I would have made playing in the NLL through a marketing addendum. Which then pays them for, you know, like, I would assume it's something like showing up to be there to sign autographs before and after the game.
It's kids' birthday parties, man. That's what it is.
Right.
Yeah. It's like appearance fees for, you know, again, yes, signing autographs, but, you know, every home game has like a birthday party thing that can happen. Like, you can buy that just like you can any other event. And that's kind of where you see a lot of guys that are on practice rosters or whatever go to those traditionally. But I think now the MLL has shifted with this attention to giving the players more money for, you know, as a compensation competition element against the NLL. Because, I mean, let's all be real here for a second. These leagues are not going to work together. These leagues do not like each other. We are not in a good space. This is not a safe space, okay? NLL versus MLL is a real thing. And this, these guys kind of, I would say, listen, I'm not firing shots, but I know some people are going to see this as them defecting to NLL. When in reality, well, it's a smart move because NLL pays like 2/3 more than an ML than an MLL does.
Like,
yeah,
two or three times more.
Two or three times more. Yes, but yeah, I'm not good with math. That's you. I'm the word guy.
Two thirds is a fraction. They pays double or triple.
The MLL pays 1/3 what the NLL does by and large. How's that?
Right.
Is that correct?
That's okay. That is the correct.
That's what I meant. That's what I meant.
Yes. No, it is a smart move, and I think that. But I think the thing to understand though is that it is some of these MLL players who are signing NLL contracts are not doing so potentially primarily with the intent of actually playing in the NLL. I mean, it has to at least be something they're interested in, or they wouldn't do it. But potentially it's more motivated because it's a way for them to gain leverage for negotiating purposes with their MLL teams.
Right.
And I think that's sort of the key point of understanding is that because there's no free agency, really, there's no true free agency, and the salary cap is so low, and there's no player union to threaten to go on strike to raise the salary cap or to get, you know, increase the potential max salary for players. This is a way that players are discovering that they have leverage over their MLL teams is by essentially by threatening to go play in the NLL. They're leveraging. Sure. They have true free agency between the leagues, and players are exploiting that to get more money.
And they should, by the way, they should.
Yeah, because they have no other leverage, basically within the structure of the MLL. Certainly.
Right, and this relates back to my point of that I've had to explain several times that the MLL thinks that the MLL is the star of the show, and they're not. The players are. The players and the teams are what make the MLL successful, not the MLL, the existence thereof. You know, I've gotten kind of called out for being like, you know, the Shield doesn't matter in the MLL. You know, people talk about the NFL Shield and all that stuff. The MLL has a similar mentality that the league is more important than the player is more important than the team. And I just think that's not the case in such a small market and in such a niche market as lacrosse. Like, there has to be more respect given.
The player, a lot of the star power the MLL exploits is built up in the college game, not in their league.
Right. And also by the player themselves, so than any other sport, I would say.
Right. That we have a case where there are players – and actually had this discussion and we looked it up and it is – similar in other sports, but we have where the social media reach of individual players is greater than the league, and it is comparable. Like LeBron James's social, like his Instagram followers, he has a very comparable number to the NBA. But you have the case in lacrosse where individual players have two or three times the social media reach of the league or any of the teams,
right?
Which is not necessary. Like it is not that skewed. In the NBA or the NFL, there are certain players who basically have equivalent media reach, but nowhere is it really greater the way it is in lacrosse.
Right. Right. And I think this is a natural progression. You know, the players are only going to, you know, average MLL career is probably not as short as an NFL career, but definitely not as long as an NBA career. You know, there are tons of guys that have come in the league and done well for like 2 years and left.
Are you sure it might be shorter than the NFL? I mean, think of how many guys...
NFL is the shortest one.
But think of how many guys, though, in the MLL, like, are just playing a game or two, you know, like, their year after college or the year after that, and then kind of exit from the lacrosse world and don't bother to get back in shape to come play again, because it's not really worth it.
I think that trend is waning. I think that you could have said that. As soon as 5 years ago, I think that's no longer the case. I think the competition for spots is much higher. And I think, you know, you would see that when there were 10 teams is the time when you would see that particular kind of criticism be true. But I think now it's very much competitive. Yes, there are more fringe players. There are more practice squad guys, you know, going up. And thanks to guys playing NLL, you're getting guys that got opportunities early on in the season when they couldn't, when the other guys couldn't play. So if you factor that in, I'm sure it's a little more skewed. But if you're looking at a player with a minimum average of five games per season, that player's career is not that long.
You see what I'm saying? That is maybe fair. I'm just saying, I think the prevalence though of guys who maybe don't even bother to try to come back for a second year or third year, it would potentially make MLL careers shorter than the NFL. But
yeah, well, I mean, that's caring about playing for your sport and making a living playing your sport are two different things.
Right, right. You know? Just, I think to say for sure that NFL careers are shorter, anyways, it's
well, those
it's
are really careers. An MLL player isn't a career.
Right,
it's not your
right.
career.
That's the point that I.
That's the main point. That's the main direction. Either way, yeah, it's interesting October discussion. We're talking gear. We're talking recruits. We're talking fall ball. We're talking MLL somehow. So you know, productive podcast. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Kyle Devitt. I'm the Gear and Lifestyle Editor. You can find me on Twitter at @TheKyleDevitt as well as Instagram.
And I am Patrick McEwen, a.k.a. the Lacrosse Film Room guy. You can find me on Twitter and Snapchat at @LaxFilmRoom and on Instagram and YouTube at @LacrosseFilmRoom. Thanks for listening, guys. We'll talk to you soon.
Peace.